in the 14th year of the reign of King Louis XVI, 1 year after the fall of the Bastille, some 350,000 men, women and children gathered on the Champ de Mars in Paris to celebrate the grand Fête de la Fédération. It rained, but it didn't detract from the feeling on the day. Talleyrand, the Bishop of Autun, celebrated Mass, and the King swore his oath of loyalty to the Constitution before an altar to the Fatherland, and you can see some of it taking place there. The festival was at once both ancient and profoundly new in its symbolism, and marked a culmination of a month of events celebrating the Federation of France and the anniversary of the Revolution. Although at root it was a military celebration or ceremony, in which the National Guardsmen gathered from across France to swear allegiance to the King and the new National Assembly, it also came to symbolise the joyous accord for the French nation as a whole, expressing hope and the desire for harmony across a troubled land. The physical space of Paris, as we can see here, had been reshaped by those very guardsmen, and indeed by the people of Paris. It was known as the Journée of the Wheelbarrows, or the Day of the Wheelbarrows, in which the earth of the old military parade ground was moved into these great banks so the spectators could witness the ceremony and take place, see what was taking place. The materials of the Ancien Régime, it might also be said, were being reshaped into a new order of things. And just as space was being reshaped, so was time. And this was one day in the calendar year which was being claimed by the nation to create a new nation. To some extent, this might come as a bit of a shock. We think of the revolution as a time of trouble and trauma, but this was a moment of as I said, of harmony and joyous accord. But it wasn't, as we know, to be. The revolution and the meaning of liberty could not remain uncontested. And the very idea of the nation became a site of contestation and fight. Louis, as we know, failed in his flight to Varennes and ended up losing his head, as did his wife, and France became a republic. In 1793, and this is what I'm really going to be talking about, time itself was republicanised, in the sense that the old Gregorian calendar, the calendar that we use, was abolished and the new republican calendar was introduced. It was declared retrospectively, so year one became, 1792 became year one of the French Republic, and this started in September, the very same moment which the new republic had been founded, and from then on the dates of the year would be marked according to the republic rather than the 10th year of the reign of Louis or whatever. So in this way, the men of 1793, and of course the women also, had seized revolutionary control of the very nature of time. The calendar, in some ways, then became a link to this brave new world, the world that replaced the old Ancien Régime, the world of the aristocracy and of the king. And this is where I want to really talk about calendars. What was the meaning of reforming calendar within this new symbolic order? And to answer that question, I'm just going to look briefly at what is a calendar for? Why is it important? And perhaps more importantly for us, what was it like to see and use and look at a calendar in the 18th century? Did 18th century men, women, children, citizens use calendars in the same way? What way did they use clocks? Did they have the same meaning as they do today? Well, this is the very appropriate place to talk about this, one of the most important uses of a calendar, and indeed where they are derived from generally, is as an astronomical tool. Partly one needs a calendar to chart where one is around the sun, for scientific reasons and for reasons of scientific endeavour, and as we know, there are very practical outcomes of this. If you want to sail across the Atlantic, you need to know where you are in terms of longitude, and you need a very accurate ability to read the stars and tell the time. So there are practical, military and commercial reasons for knowing where you are in relation to the sun and the stars. So that's clearly the first important use of the calendar. Religion is also one of the most important aspects of the calendar, as you know, and for most of Europe provided the basis for measuring time. And if we think about who controlled time, it's certain that the Catholic Church felt that it did. The Gregorian calendar, of course, was introduced by Pope Gregory. It controlled when the saints' days were. It controlled when Easter was, and so forth. So the very system of the calendar was defined by the Church, going back to Bede and before that, of course, as well. The Church also claimed authority for things like saints' days, and these would be used for other markers in society, which I'll come onto in a moment. The calendar also operated in this mode as perhaps a unifying system, a sort of a cosmology, if you will, a way of understanding the world. The religious calendar was mapped onto the day-to-day calendar, and within the religious year, there's the story of Christ's birth, death and resurrection, and the various aspects of the religious year. So it provided a symbolic framework for the subjects of the nation, of the state. And the patterns of saints' days and feasts and festivals structured social life. Now, competing with this, perhaps, is the time of society. And society in all its forms, everything from balls and dances and the opera, through to public lectures. And here's a public lecture taking place in Paris, people going into the halls to listen in a salon. How do these events get structured? How do people know when there would be a dance or a theatre? What times of day do they take place? How do people know that they took place at these times? This is where tools like almanacs come into play, newspapers and so on. And all these events became a way of informing society and structuring society, particularly in terms of class and gender. If you were rich, for example, you would take great pleasure in being able to get up late, being able to go to the grand dances or balls or the theatre late at night because you could afford candles and a man to walk in front of you with a torch. You could sort of conquer the natural world, as it were. If you were poor, you were very much beholden to the seasons and the natural order of things, perhaps going back to that astronomical view of the calendar. So society also makes, as we know, it's obvious, lots of demands on the calendar. And the underlying question in the 18th century, and taking the view of the calendar in a more historical sense, is society getting more complicated during this period? Are we looking at a more modern society compared to the early modern and maybe medieval society, which of course were very complicated? But is this a point in which people are demanding a more complicated system of organising society, increasingly complicated societies, ones in which factories had to operate, armies had to march, merchants had to coordinate their buying and selling and speculation on grain futures and so on. Which leads on, I suppose, to business, and there's a big debate about at what time did the merchant calendar take over from the church calendar, and people could, whichever sort of period one studies a historian, people argue it took place at different times. Jacques Le Goff argued in the medieval period, for example, merchant time was very important, and people, merchants used their own secular calendar as much as the church calendar. Classical historians, going before that, have also argued that merchant time was incredibly important as opposed to the imperial calendar, which was a more festival-based calendar. So this competition between, I suppose, the business of the church and the symbolism of the state and the day-to-day needs of a merchant calendar is something which is always in flux. And finally, in this little section about how does a calendar operate in this time, there are also other things going on, not just almanacs and calendars and people memorising the months and the days of the week and when the festivals and saints' days are. There are the natural symbols, natural order of things. And here we have a painting of the harvest, Northern Europe. And to us, it's quite an idyllic scene, perhaps. But to the early modern viewer, there may be an allegory here. We see the church in the distance, in which there would be a bell. There's the time of the seasons and the weather. You can see the clouds gathering on the left there. The harvest itself is half cut, half brought in, and they have to do that before the rain arrives. A man here is drinking on the right, so he's perhaps not pulling his weight. So there's also a sense of urgency as well as perhaps bucolic idealism here. But throughout rural society, and if we look at France at this time, 28 million perhaps, maybe 80, 90% of them lived in the countryside. This is their, or our world as it were. It's the time of the seasons, of the harvest, of the sun, of the moon and so on. But it wasn't just that. Here is I think 1803, something like that, print of the Tableau de Paris, one of many songs produced at the time. And can't quite make it out, but it's saying what's happening at 5 o'clock in the morning in Paris, and a lot is going on. So there's bustle and activity, street criers, markets, a new trap there being pulled by a donkey, but still going quite fast. And there is a vast outpouring in the late 18th century of plays and poems and so on, talking about hustle and bustle of modern life, modern urban life, how busy we all are now, how noisy the town is, what a shock it is when you come in from the countryside where you're used to the slow harvest and come into the bustle of the countryside. So time as a trope is used to discuss these things, these changes that might be taking place in society. And they're also given a moral twist as well. The rural scene we saw clearly had some moral layer on top of it, and here as well it points to the risks that the city might bring to the innocent who comes and is lost in its hustle and bustle. There had also been lots of reforms in the 18th century of time, and lots of calendars. In Britain, as you know, we use the Julian calendar, despite John Dee's efforts to reform it, and that lasted until 1752, when we followed the rest of, well, I say the rest of Europe, but there are also pockets of Protestant countries following the Julian calendar here and there, and then we have the Russians following their calendar as well, and then the Greek Orthodox and so on. So people are used to different calendars, and travel books at the time are very keen on pointing out how time is measured, how clocks in Italy ring at certain hours at different times, and how the day starts in the evening, things like that. The time at sea is measured in a different way as well. And there's also the anthropological interest of the 18th century and every account of different civilizations or different peoples, whether it's in Iceland or in Africa or Asia, has an account of their peculiar or interesting and different timekeeping systems. So it's an age of awareness of different timekeeping patterns, different calendars, and there's lots of discussion about what is the best sort of calendar, what's the most accurate and scientific one, which one is most aligned to the natural world and helps you sail across the seas. And there we can see just a small snippet from a print of Hogarth's election series in which there's a placard saying, "Give us our 11 days." And Stephen Poole, a historian, has written some interesting articles in the book on how this was largely a myth. There were no riots in 1752. Sadly, people accepted the calendar reforms quite easily. Even the rose in Glastonbury bloomed on the new Christmas Day, so it all happened very, very easily. And really, Hogarth is making a sort of political point here, and it was used as in the battle between the Whigs and the Tories. But there's very little evidence for anybody getting too upset about the loss of the 11 days. There were a lot of adjustments made in terms of financial calculations and annuities and rent agreements and so on, but no rioting in the streets. So that's England and perhaps Europe more generally. I'm zooming in now onto France. And in 1788, this man, Sylvain Maréchal, illustrated the dangers that could come to you if you meddled with the calendar. He was imprisoned for publishing his own secular calendar, the Almanach de Honnêtes-Gens, which was condemned as impious and blasphemous and was burnt in the street. He was the son of a Paris wine merchant, a lawyer. Well, he's trained as a lawyer and never really practiced, and saw himself really as a man of the Republic of Letters, this international movement bringing reform and reason to Europe and the world. And he wanted to do away with what he saw as the superstition of the saints' days and the arbitrary nature of the calendar. So he renamed all the months in this calendar, using Roman sort of principles all the way through, through Princeps all the way through to Dieu de Son. And then he renamed each day of the year, rather than after a saint, but after a great man. So Christmas Day was Jesus Christ, but also Newton. He also included his own father and left the 15th of August blank, which happens to be Napoleon's birthday, but it wasn't because of that. It was because it's Sylvie Maréchal's birthday, and maybe he thought one day he would have his own birthday in his calendar. And he thought this was a good idea because he wanted to reduce the authority of the Catholic Church to some extent. But he also thought that this would be useful for and I'm going to quote here, the Catholic and the Protestant, the Lutheran and the Anglican, the Christian and the Muslim, the idolater and the Hebrew alike. So there is a whiff of toleration and as well as irreligion in his calendar. And he wanted to provide a new neutral way of measuring time, and one that, by tinkering around the edges, he said was also more accurate. It was quite well known at the time as well, and shows how calendar reform was in the air, just as there was lots of pamphlets coming out about the French Revolution. Well, I say the French Revolution, but about what to do about the French question, how to refinance the French state at a time of social turmoil. And I mentioned Men of the Republic of Letters, and I just draw attention here to a print from the Encyclopédie Diderot and Alain Berg's Encyclopedia. And this is one of the many, many illustrations, beautifully done, of clockwork. They invited the many of the leading horologists of the day to write on how to create clockwork pieces, and their sections in the encyclopedia on time are very, very lengthy. There's an entry on time, there's an entry on horology, there's an entry on calendar. It crops up here, there and everywhere, and they go into it in great detail, listing all the various systems that there are in the world. And even in the discussion of the metric system, they even speculate in a footnote about how that might be applicable to the time as well. So there is a strong sense of, in this Republic of Letters, that time is up for reform as well as everything else. So we're at the French Revolution now, after 20 minutes, and here we see the storming of the Bastille. As you know, this was a great moment of political crisis, of economic dislocation, and probably represents the collapse of the French state at the centre. The political centre couldn't really hold, and a political crisis turns into a social crisis, and people take to the streets. At this point here, they're trying to get into the Bastille to get some gunpowder and some guns to defend themselves against the rumours of Prussian and foreign troops, which the king is going to send against them, or some of the people who are advising the king might send against them. And this leads to, as we know, what we call the French Revolution, in which the king eventually becomes beholden to the National Assembly, a new constitution is drawn up, becomes more radicalised. Eventually the king, after he flees to Varennes, is tried and executed, and France becomes a republic. And I'll just as an aside point out, as well as storming the Bastille in their search for gunpowder, they also stormed the Paris, or the Royal Observatory in the south of Paris, in the search for gunpowder, and smashed up telescopes whilst they were about it. Sadly, I haven't found a contemporary illustration of that, but it's the lesser known storming of July 1789. I was going to talk a little bit about what the French Revolution is in the sense of what do historians say it was. And for 20 years or more, ever since the Revolution, people have been arguing about what it was, what caused it, and what was the meaning of it. Is it too early to say what the meaning of it is? And here's Albert Soubouls, who was one of the main proponents of what we might call the Marxist and the Marxist-on theory, which was saying it was very much a clash between classes. Most historians tend to argue it was a political crisis. And this is a debate which still goes on, but historians have also asked about what happens next. If the Ancien Régime collapses, or what became known as the Ancien Régime collapses, something new was put in its place, a republic based on rights and liberty and the rule of law and the idea of the nation. And where'd that idea come from? How do you go about creating a new nation? What sort of institutions and cultural manifestations does that take? And what does that mean in the way we look at our own society, perhaps? So the revolution is very much about reforms, about reforming and rebuilding the French nation. And I started with the Champ de Mars, reshaping Paris or bits of Paris. And here we see them reshaping the Ancien, or the old provinces of the Kingdom of France. The various bits that have been taken over in conflict and sort of brought into the French state, all of which have their own slightly different legal systems, and certainly have their own different system of weights and measures and internal customs barriers. So if you want to send grain from the south up to Paris, you'll have to pay all sorts of fees on the way up. The measurements in which the merchant buys its grain from in the Midi and then sends it to Nantes may well be a different weight and measure. So it's very hard to establish order over the nation. And the French, borrowing an idea from Thomas Jefferson, try and impose a grid of 100 regular departments. Doesn't quite work, of course. There's lots of argument and debate about who's going to be the capital and which department or province would have a representation in the new nation. But it's divided up in this much more regularised system. So we have one of the many reforms of the revolution, the reform of space. And I suppose the guiding principles of this were the ideas of reason and of the natural world. In some ways, there's a bit of a contradiction trying to impose a grid on a rather bumpy hexagon. But there was a belief that that represents some sort of harmony, I suppose, some sort of higher truth. And there was a strong belief that all the new weights and measures in which this new land would be mapped would also be based very rigorously on the earth itself. So the meter would be a division of the circumference of the earth. The centigrade and so on would be freezing of water. Weight would be a certain mass of water as well. So everything would be tied together. And I suppose the meter is the most well-known of these. And you can just about make it out there. Here's one of the meters on public display, which everybody can go to and take their measurements from. And there was a long pre-revolutionary debate about the best way to measure space. And as part of the many proposals that were received by the king during this pre-revolutionary moment in which he asked people's ideas about what to do about the trouble that the French state is in, there are lots of proposals for reforming weights and measures. Two reasons, really. It would make trade more efficient, and it would also be more scientifically accurate and rational. And we get proposals from Turgot, Necker, many others as well. And quite quickly, proposals from figures such as Antoine Lavoisier on the 27th of June to combine weights and measures under one unifying system which would be controlled from Paris and be designed by scientists rather than be something that is inherited. And there is a whole series of proposals sparked off by that again, which come into this newly formed government in 1789, and a committee is set up to decide what to do about weights and measures, and a commission is set up. And as we know, there was a series of expeditions eventually dispatched to the meridian and the equator to measure the size of the Earth. This takes some time, and whilst these endeavours are going on, people like Lavoisier fall foul of the revolution. There's also an initial proposal to have the meter calculated in three nations, in America at a Monticello, in London or Greenwich, and in Paris at the same time, and takes off an average of those measurements. The fallout with Britain, the war that is declared, stops that proposal happening. But there is an initial desire to have a universal measure, and it will be the based essentially on the swing of 1 second, 1 second oscillation at a particular point above sea level, and that will provide the initial basis for the metre. For sort of all sorts of complicated reasons, that isn't the final decision. But there is this quite utopian moment in which this Republic of Letters would somehow seize the opportunity to create a unified and international system, even at this point in time. And the other thing, I suppose the important point about all this, it was going to be decimal. The metre would be divided by 10. Well, less divided by 10, because the old sort of duodecimal system, base 12, is actually easy to divide things. The metrical system, or the decimal system, would be easy to multiply. 10 is sort of how we calculate in those ways. So if you're expanding out, seeing the world in those terms of large distances, large sums, multiplying, predicting into the future, then it makes sense to use the decimal system. So, by 1792, something else is also happening. There's the Committee of Public Instruction, which is the Committee of Public Education, and is designed to pull together a series of national festivals to create a national system of education, to take control of the Commission of Weights and Measures, and essentially create a new France in a cultural and symbolic way even. And they have to come up, use and call upon scientists to answer these questions which are becoming increasingly pressing. And one of those questions is, when does the new year start? I showed you the taking of the Bastille in 1789, in July, and newspapers very quickly started talking about, this is now our first year of liberty. The next year, they would say this is our second year of liberty, and so on. After various events, such as the first constitution, then they would start talking about the year of reason, and so on. And it all got very confusing, not least, when did the year start? Did it start on the 1st of January, or did it start on the anniversary? But most importantly, all official acts had to be dated according to the seal of the Republic. If we think about acts of Parliament here, they're in the whatever reign of Charles the whatever, or George the Third. That's how they're dated. It's that rather than it being the Anno Domini system. So legal acts needed to be dated in the first year of the Republic or whatever, so the seal could be designed and made. And so the committee was asked to look into this, come up with an answer. So it began its deliberations. And then it was also given a further sort of challenge or demand, and that was to bring into harmony the old and the new eras. And that's all they were asked to do. And that was the question of bringing in this sense of when is the first year of liberty, when is the first year of reason, when does the year begin, to some extent, but to bring them into harmony. And I think it speaks to the utopian and sort of idealistic spirit of the age that they took this so much further, particularly at a time in which France was riven by internal civil war. The provinces were rebelling against Paris. France itself was being invaded by Prussia. And so it was men like Fabre d'Oglantine, whose name is perhaps most associated with the calendar, and Charles Gilbert Rome here, who were on the Committee of the Public Instruction. Gilbert Rome was the chairman of the committee, to really extend the brief, I suppose. And through the summer of 1793, Rome here was on mission to Normandy, where he was supposed to be suppressing a rebellion. He didn't do a very good job because he was captured and put into prison, along with Prieur de Côte d'Or as well. And so they had probably 40 days of time on their hands. And the suspicion is this is when they cooked up the Republican calendar, as it became known as. And they come back to Paris and then launch on a rather unsuspecting convention this new calendar, this new system. Rome presents the first version of it, and Fabre, who we just saw, presents the second version of it. And I think their prints speak quite well to their different personalities. Fabre d'Eglantine saw himself as a playwright and a poet, garlanded with honours. He eventually came into cropper in this some complicated scandal involving overseas investment and trade with the British and so on, and was guillotined. Gilbert Rome, much more austere, was convicted or was part of what's known as the Prairial Uprising, in which the more radical elements of the revolutionary sans-culotte tried to pull the revolution back to the left, back to the radical direction. So he was implicated in this plot, was sent to the guillotine, but rather than being guillotined, he managed to smuggle a knife in and sort of fell on his knife in the Roman fashion and killed himself. And just before this, he wrote a letter to his wife saying, "It is now the decade of the 10th day. Please don't forget to give money to the poor, as is our tradition." So he was a very Spartan, Republican, in the classical sense, figure. And Fabre is the man who's famed for coming up with the names of the months, which I'll get into in a moment, whereas Gilbert Rome was obsessed, really, with the science behind it and the relevance it would also have for the natural world and the agricultural world. His heart was really in farming and in agronomy, and he really saw the future of France as being in using science to develop the land and create modern crops like the potato and so on. So as I said, they come back, or Rome comes back from being on mission. He presents his new system. It's this point, September or October, because it takes a few weeks to go through the committee stages, and France is going for a very radical time. Here is Marie Antoinette, and the famous David sketch, where her hair is turned white just before she's sent to the guillotine. Bills are being passed every few days about how the increasingly, or by this point, the Jacobin convention is going to save France from internal civil war, from internal danger, and defend itself from external threats. This is a time when France is really, and the Republic is really under extreme pressure. All sorts of measures are passed at this time, measures such as restricting the price of bread, and increasingly clamping down on religious activity as well. So it's perhaps no surprise that something as innocuous as calendar reform is snuck through. And here it is. Here is the first or second printing of the Republican calendar, with the seal on the front, declared by the convention. A long preamble explaining how a new book of history is opened and a new burin is needed to engrave the events of our day, and that it is a system much like Sylvain Maréchal's almanac that will be applicable to all, whether they're Catholic or Protestant or deist or of no belief. And it will also begin, and this is a crucial point, on the anniversary of the French Republic, which happened to coincide with the autumnal equinox in 22nd of September. 1792. And I suppose in the popular mind, this series of images is what we most associate with the calendar, rather than that very austere, we'll just jump back to it, classical interpretation of the calendar. The first printing of it lists the new months of the year, and the new months are going to be 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 12th month. The days of the week are similarly going to be listed in numerical order. And it takes, as I said, Fabre's sort of more romantic vision to come up with what we know of as the Republican months of the year. And here they are. So I'll quickly take you through the structure of the calendar. It starts in autumn. In some ways, quite, you know, those in education, it's the year you go back to school, it somehow seems like the start of the year. But it's also when the Republic was founded, so it's now, it would then be year two of the Republic, which swings around every September. And the names of the months align to the agricultural seasons of the year. We start off the month of vintage, work our way through. We're just on the cusp of the month of mist, all the way through to the month of fruit, and so the system carries on. They were grouped into seasons. Seasons were seen as the scientific basis of the year, even if, you know, meteorologists would argue whether they exist or not. And there were still 12 months in the year, so decimalisation could only go so far. Largely, I think, for reasons of mathematics, how long it takes to go around the Earth, reasons of the anatomistic sense of the Moon, and also because of this classical heritage, this Roman Grecian heritage, which the French revolutionaries wanted to pick up and carry on with. So the months are given new names. You might raise your hands and object to say that applies to Paris, but not so much to Nice or even Italy or Haiti or Saint-Domingue, which was something people pointed out at the time, that these agricultural and seasonal names of the year have their own problems. But within those months, decimalisation was introduced. So each month had 30 days, 3 weeks within those 30 days of 10 days apiece. And each day of the year would no longer have a saint's day. It would have an agricultural name. And today is the day of the goat. And here we have a goat on the right from Marie Antoinette's sort of play garden or play farm. And that's because it's the fifth day of the week. And the fifth day of the week always had something quite substantial, usually four or two-legged. The other days of the week were something like a potato or a... but it structured the week. And Wednesday, or not Wednesday, the fifth day would also perhaps be a half day off. Schools would have Wednesday afternoon off, and civil servants would have the fifth day off so they could have their goat's cheese or whatever. And as you went through the year, you would learn about all sorts of things. The hoe... wild ginger, the potato, which I keep coming back to, but that's seen as the great innovation, throughout all 360 days of the year. That leaves, and some of you will be ahead of me on this, 5 days left over, and those will be rounded up in the Roman style into a series of festivals at the end of the year. And within the day itself, and here we are, we have the decimalisation of time. They thought it'd be, and introduced at the same time, a 10-hour day. And here we can see a clock measuring the 10 hours and the duodecimal hours around the outside. Within the 10 hours, there would be 100 minutes in each hour, and each hour, or new hour, would have 100 seconds, and they would be subdivided as well. And this, it was said, much more closely aligned to the heartbeat of a man as he's marching along. So there's a military aspect as well. So the new second would be aligned to the, you know, beating of one's heart. I don't think that quite matches up with medical science, but there it is. So you have this whole system working out from the very second through to a cosmological statement that the French Republic happily coincides with the equinox, so it's tied in with the very sort of circuit of the sun that the Earth takes. And it will be tied in as well to the system of meters and kilograms once they're eventually decided upon. This is the first bit of metrification that actually is introduced. It's some time ahead of the meter and so on. And you also have at the same time the decimalisation of coinage as well. And being a modern and sort of vibrant society, and one that wants to make money, they see clockmaking as a very vital part of the new French nation, and spend a lot of money attracting Swiss clockmakers over to Besançon in the southeast of France, in the Doubs, and having a series of competitions to come up with decimal clocks, either ways of easily converting your old clock or cheap clocks that the sans-culottes could buy and wear and use. And there are a series of awards to clockmakers to introduce these new clocks. And as you can see, one of them upstairs, and also be aware that not many were actually produced. They are incredibly valuable and collected by horologists around the world still. Much more popular were just simple paper dials that you could either do the conversion, or you could put on top of your dial, so you could have the hour, if not the minutes, correct. Because the minute hand would still go around in 6 seconds, but the hours would do a revolution twice every 24 hours, so you'd have 5 hours around the outside of your clock. They also made an effort to convert the clock in the various civic buildings. Again, it took quite a while to actually introduce this clock in Tuileries, Paris, and also in Toulouse one was introduced. And so by the time they were actually introduced and they were there hanging over debates, the requirement to follow this system had been dropped. By 1795, it was no longer part of the Republican calendar. This metric system continued, but it wasn't part of the laws and legislation that controlled the calendar. And the question, which I'll probably deal with in the questions, is how was this received? And really, that's what I was looking at in my dissertation, and a few other people have looked at it as well. The first thing to say is it lasted until 1806, so it was, you know, it was a good, depending on how you measure it, at least 12 years. It was the measure used to by the Louisiana Purchase, so the most expensive financial transaction at the time took place according to, at least partly according to the Republican calendar. And if you spend any time in the archives, you'll see printed on the top the various dates in the Republican calendar, and you imagine the pure bureaucrats having to get used to this new system. As you'd expect, there are a lot of mistakes initially. People take a while to get used to this new system. Spelling is often awry. They get it wrong. Dates of meetings in revolutionary towns are particularly keen on using this new system and then try and use the new decimal hours to measure their meetings. So we met today at... And you can tell they're often still meeting on the old hours, because they say we met today at... something like 3:42, so that equates to 9 o'clock in the morning or whatever. So decimal time doesn't really take off. It's only people like Saint-Just who are known to have a decimal watch on, which they carry around and as a mark of their Republican sentiment, which he actually has on him when he's arrested and sent to the guillotine. So in the towns and in year two, it seemed to be the thing to do, and if you want to be a Republican, you follow the Republican calendar. You don't walk around on Sundays in your Sunday best unless you want to really make a point. And there I came across surveillance committees which found people walking around in their Sunday best and hauled them in front of various surveillance committees, and probably led to no end of trouble for them. So it initially meets with a certain amount of acceptance amongst revolutionaries and in the towns, and then it fades quite quickly. Still officially the calendar of France, but it's not really imposed. There's no compulsion either. There's no fine. You could just find yourself in trouble with the Jacobin Committee. Where it really is imposed, and I'll just sort of begin to wrap up now, is during the Directory. And here's Fouché, who is well known as under Napoleon as being his Minister of Police and various other things. But this is a time in which France has been through terrible trouble and turmoil. Robespierre's been overthrown. The Thermidorian reaction, so-called, comes in, which sort of wheels back some of the most radical aspects of the revolution. There's been a civil war. There's great fear of brigands and rioting and crime. So come 1795, and particularly 1797, there's a real desire for order. And by 1797, there's also a sort of a move towards the left as well. And the Directory introduces two bits of legislation that are really quite striking. They say you can't work publicly on the old Sundays, and you have to observe the Decady, the 10th day, which is declared a holiday. Every citizen, every soldier, school child has to take part in these festivals on the 10th day. And if you don't, you'll be fined. And throughout France, throughout these years, you find watch committees going around, seeing if, I've had examples of mussel sellers being spotted, people working outside their house in Besançon. In Avignon, they were particularly keen to clamp down on signs of the old calendar. And so for these sort of, well, depending on how you measure it, five to six years, the calendar is imposed with a certain amount of regularity. This is the only point in time which France has an effective administrative and bureaucratic and policing system able to impose its will throughout France. It doesn't happen where there are areas of counter-revolution. It doesn't happen in the countryside. There's no real way of imposing the calendar in the countryside. But it does happen in towns and cities and in Paris, and foreign visitors often comment on how people follow the 10-day system. And the point is, I suppose, to go back to the start of the talk, it is how do people follow time at the time? We think, oh gosh, you wouldn't have a weekend, but of course you didn't have a weekend then. If anything, you very much regretted not being able to drink or work on a Sunday because you needed to work to survive. So to be able to work for longer was seen as, by many people, as a good thing. Similarly, if you wanted to drink, you were no longer stopped from drinking during the hours of Mass and so on. So there was quite a few reasons to adopt the new calendar. If you were a mayor, you could also readjust your markets. You could have a market on this new system, and maybe you didn't have a market before, but suddenly you could have a market on the fifth day, and the local village nearby would lose trade to you. So there are all sorts of opportunities raised by the new calendar, and some people seem to quite make use of it, particularly, again, this sort of bureaucratic class. And so fairs and markets, I suppose, I just flag up as one point at which the market, you can measure how much the calendar was followed. And a historian called Jack Thomas has looked at the fairs in Provence. And yes, the new system of fairs and markets was imposed. They met every 10th day. Old fairs and markets also took place as well. So you actually have many, many more markets, which is not really the desired outcome. Largely, again, the men of the encyclopedia really wanted to cut down on the numbers of fairs and markets, seeing as economically inefficient. But it to the historian, leaves a certain amount of evidence to how the calendar was followed. I haven't talked about religion, but apart from to say that the calendar was designed as a secular rather than an anti-clerical instrument, although it very quickly became used as an anti-clerical instrument. It was supposed to be a neutral measure of time, but very quickly became a way of clamping down on the activities of the non-constitutional church. And here we see the Festival of the Supreme Being, which was one of the many attempts to impose a new religious order or a new secular national order onto the calendar, onto those festivals that took place every 10th day and onto those festivals that took place on the 5th day at the end of the year. Policing was perhaps the thing that the calendar didn't really come to grips with, but, and this comes back to the start of the talk, and the idea of time in the 18th century, what is it that the calendar is doing? On the one level, yes, it's talking about the cosmology and the symbolism of the world, what the future will bring, the sort of a Christian view of the world or a nationalistic view of the world or a Republican view of the world. But on a very practical level, the calendar was very much about when could you have your fairs and markets, how long could you drink? When could you sell mussels? What time could you start slaughtering animals in the street? When could you use particular gates to come into the city? And these are all things about regulating society. And the calendar fits into perhaps a longer-term trend of regulation, of policing, of stopping gaming, of stopping disorder on the streets. And in this way, we can see the calendar fitting into a longer-term sort of centralising and controlling principle which emerges in during the French Revolution. And it's very much part of nation-building. And perhaps it's also the story of science, of using state control of things which might be neutral, such as just measurement and time, to actually interfere into everyday life. Okay, now just to conclude, it did come to an end. Year 14, it was finally abolished halfway through the year, or just at the beginning, and 1806 was reintroduced by Napoleon. He didn't get rid of it straight away. During the Concordat with Rome, there was no mention of reintroducing the Gregorian calendar. He was crowned according to it and so on. His brother was very keen on it, and he didn't just do away with it. He got an official scientific body to meet and decide what would happen. A lot of the newspapers said it's very difficult now we have an empire to coordinate all these calendars because it's hard to impose it. It's very hard to do trade. But the real reason that it was abolished, and this is the reason that they stated, was because, and this goes back to the beginnings of the calendar, that autumnal equinox, as observed in Paris, which turns out in the science of the day is very hard to do. It changes slightly. It's hard to, well, you can observe it, but then you have to measure it, and there's a slight delay there, so it's not accurate. And it's just been February the 29th, so it's been a leap year, and the calendar didn't deal brilliantly with leap years. I think something after 1400 years or thereabouts, it's the way it coped with the leap year would cause it to be fall out of alignment with the observance of the equinox. Jules Baron was aware of this, and him and some scientists have worked on a solution, and they proposed the solution, but it was never passed by the French government, and before it could be passed, he fell on his sword. So the calendar was still following this flawed system of intercalation of measuring the leap years. So this was the excuse, or the reason, depending on your suspicions of why it was abolished, why Napoleon got rid of the calendar and reintroduced the Gregorian calendar. In terms of its legacy, though, it was it lived on. Here we have the 1871 Paris Commune, which very quickly adopted the Republican calendar in sort of a statement of Republican pride, as the Prussians and the French government were surrounding this bastion of republicanism in Paris. In Russia, as soon as the revolution happened there, they moved and reformed calendar to a more modern system. In Cambodia as well, there was the talk of the year zero, even though there was actually no official year zero. It was just a bit of propaganda, as it were, but it's something that is sort of stuck in the Western mind anyway. And it seems very much as a totem of the left, and you have throughout the 19th century accounts of Republican groups publishing Republican calendars, coming up with reforms of the calendar, following this model, which would be more reasoned, more rational. Stalin also comes up with a new reform of the calendar, sort of a series of five-day weeks and different colours of different weeks and so on. But, and I don't sort of undermine to some extent the achievements of the calendar, when the French royalty was re-established, they very quickly got rid of the metric system, and it took much longer, arguably, to introduce the metric system of weights and measures in France and throughout the world than the calendar had. So weights and measures, I suppose, well, how people buy their vegetables, it seems to be a crucial thing. Maybe time is perhaps less crucial, who knows. And I suppose the other aspect of the calendar, which really did represent a shift. On the one hand, we still today have the debate in France about secularisation. What does a secular society look like? How do you have a public space that allows people of all religions to participate in. And the French answer, or Sarkozy's answer, which may be for political reasons, is to forbid certainly Islamic symbols. And that also relates to Catholic symbols as well, or have done in the past. And that is a legacy of the calendar. And the other real legacy of the calendar, I suppose, is that it's no longer the domain of the church or of tradition. After the French Republic has involved itself so closely with the calendar and set up a series of administrative bodies to take care of it, this is the pattern for the rest of Western society and indeed most of the world now, that the state controls time, the state decides when holidays are, time is regulated according to the centre and is based on some sort of scientific basis rather than traditional basis. So today we almost are moving away from the circuit of the sun, and we're moving towards a sort of an abstract measurement of time. It wasn't passed by the international time body, but we're moving in that way. So we'll measure a abstract notion of time rather than a observed and traditional measure of time. So I should probably stop at that point. There's a picture of the book which goes into this into much more detail, with pictures as well. Or could it work? Federal bookstores and libraries as well, I came to point out, so it should be in the Bodley over there. And if you're interested, I have some flyers for a discount of 25% off. It's still £37.50, I'm afraid, but that's academic publishing today. So thank you very much, and any questions?